Bone-chilling greetings, everyone. The tunes are courtesy of the lovely Bobby Mackey, and I, of course, am your host, Tessa Morrow. Thanks for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers podcast part of your morning, day, night, graveyard shift, whenever you listen and wherever you are listening from tiny village to the largest of cities that never sleep, from desolate desert where your nearest neighbor is a cactus to ski resort town nestled up in the mountains. And, yeah, you guessed it, baby, everything in between. It is greatly appreciated.
Round of applause. This week's city shout-out goes to...
Chino, California. Manchester, Connecticut. Hamilton, New Zealand. Hanoi, Vietnam. Warren, Michigan. And Colmar, France. The almighty and... dare I say, notorious triangle. I've done several episodes about these types of locations. The Alaska Triangle, the Massachusetts Bridgewater Triangle, Vermont's Bennington Triangle, and of course the four-part series of, the Bermuda Triangle. Yes, I would say to call any of these triangles notorious. Well, it's very appropriate. Connected forever to death, missing people, freak accidents, murders, planes and ships being swallowed alive, forcing God only knows how many people to their watery graves. Yes, notorious indeed. Today we're going to talk about the Michigan Triangle. The corners meet at Manitowoc, Wisconsin, Ludington, Michigan, and Benton Harbor, Michigan. The weather, it's very temperamental. It can go from a beautiful, gorgeous, sunny, windless day to a completely out-of-nowhere storm, even shocking seasoned mariners. HistoryCollection.com shares some interesting facts when it comes to the Great Lakes. Quote, Lake Michigan, from a distance, seems to be a tranquil body of water that is more like a sea than a lake. Lake Michigan is a part of the massive North American chain of Great Lakes. They include Lake Superior, Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, Lake Erie, and Lake Ontario. At 307 miles long and 118 miles wide, Lake Michigan is the second largest of these lakes by volume and third largest by surface area. It is the only Great Lake completely within the United States boundaries, averaging 279 feet deep at its deepest 923 feet. It boasts 1,640 miles of shoreline on which 12 million people call home, unquote. While Lake Michigan is the second largest of the Great Lakes, the largest lake is, of course, it's all in the name, Lake Superior. And here's a fun fact about Lake Superior. It is the largest freshwater lake, volume-wise, in the entire world. That's damned impressive in my book. History Collection shares that an estimated 6,000 to 8,000 ships have sank to their watery graves at the Great Lakes, and that several thousand, they said around 30,000 of people, have died here. And Detroit Free Press shares a haunting fact that more than 1,350 people have drowned here in the Great Lakes in just the past 15 years. And close to half of that number took place in the beautiful, but let's face it, the notorious Lake Michigan. They mention that many people get caught in rip currents, and they give some really good advice. Advice that can, well, let's face it, save a life. So I too want to share that. Just in case somebody who's listening is planning a trip or is somewhere where they could get caught in rip currents, it's good to know. And I quote Detroit Free Press, quote, "Rip currents will not pull a swimmer under. Instead, it will carry them out to open water, away from shore. To escape this rip, experts offer what's known as the 3 F's rule: flip, float, follow the safest path back to shore. They warn not to fight the current, but swim to the side," unquote. So 3 F's, my friends: flip, float, follow the safest path back to shore. It could save your life or someone else's. Now, haunting statistics to follow in that same article, and mind you, this is just from Lake Michigan, not the other Great Lakes. In 2010, 38 people die. 2011, there are 44 deaths. While 49 die the following year, that being 2012, both 2013 and 2014, they each see 24 deaths. 2015 has 25 deaths. 2016, it skyrockets to 46 people dying. In 2017, 40 people would breathe their last breath there. 2018, 43 deaths. 2019, 48 deaths. And in 2020, we see the highest in that chunk of years with a whopping 56 deaths. 2021 is 48 deaths. 2022, 45 deaths. And 2023, 41 deaths. Last year in 2024, there were 51 deaths. And this year, 2025, so far, the number is at 19 people dying. But again, we still have a few months to go. So I pray that this number, which is already high, 19 too many in my book, does not rise. Remember, guys, flip, float, follow the safest path back to shore. Just these years alone adds up to over 600 deaths, a whopping 641 deaths to be more exact. And that is just in Lake Michigan, and it's truly heartbreaking. Now I want to talk about some of the events that have taken place here in the Michigan Triangle. And to start from the beginning, well, the first known disappearance, we must go back into time, almost 346 years. In 1679, when a sailing vessel known as Le Griffon vanishes without a trace. It was one mid-September day in 1679. The Le Griffon, with at least 6 men on board, went to venture out on the beautiful sailing vessel, and they're never seen again. There are stories and theories, of course, of what happened and took place, but what truly happened that day? Well, sadly, it remains a mystery of all time. A sign there commemorates the Le Griffon. The voyage of the Griffon, 1679, first ship to sail Lake Erie, Huron, and Michigan. The Griffon, probably 40 to 45 feet long, was built by Robert Cavalier Sieur de la Soleil. Several miles above Niagara Falls in 1679, La Soleil came to the New France in 1667, became seigneur of Catarose, engaged in the fur trade and sought a western route to China. In August 1679, the Griffon sails from the Niagara River with La Soleil and a company of about 33 people. In this vicinity, the crew had to haul the ship up the swift current of the St. Clair River. La Salle remained in the west while the Griffin, laden with furs, vanished en route from Green Bay to Niagara. In 1681, La Salle would send two of his explorers to search for any remains, debris, anything at all of the Griffin. They did show up with pieces of the ship and had even communicated with local Potawatomi people, and I quote discovermagazine.com. After La Salle left Le Griffin, he learned the ship sheltered at an island near the tip of Green Bay for the night. The next morning, the Potawatomi recognized a violent storm was imminent and warned the captain not to set sail. He replied that his ship was not afraid of the winds and he would do as he pleased. After Le Griffin left the island shelter, it headed out into the storm and was lost at sea. La Salle's letter indicated the explorers he sent in search of the wreck were able to recover recognizable pieces of the vessel. Given that it was the only European vessel on Lake Michigan at the time, there would be no confusion as to the piece's origins. Unquote. To this day, the whereabouts of the Le Griffin remain an absolute mystery. Many shipwreck hunters have searched far and wide, and while some shipwrecks were discovered, they always prove not to be Le Griffin. In 1873, 194 years after the Griffin vanished, a discovery on Lake Huron raises some flags. At that time, a lighthouse was being constructed there, and the resident keeper couldn't help but notice a shipwreck not too far from the Mississisiagi, lighthouse. It wouldn't be until 14 years later, that being in 1887, when six bodies would be found in the area. Four of the skeletons were discovered behind a boulder, while two skeletons were found in a cave nearby. They were carefully wrapped in birch bark, and during this time, it was assumed that they were Native Americans. Can this possibly be Le Griffin? Some believe it is, but others don't think for a second that it is the Griffin, and that it is still out there somewhere waiting to be discovered. And if it is not the Griffin, what shipwreck is it? And who were those six people that were found? Again, it's one for the mystery books, my friends. We now leave 1679 and travel 181 years forward, now finding ourselves in 1860 on the 8th day of September. Enter Lady Elgin. She had only 9 years under her belt when she met her ever-so-tragic fate. Built in 1851, costing a whopping $95,000, today that's almost $4 million, this 252-foot wood hull steamship was considered a first-class steamer. She was elegant. She was popular. The Ritz-Carlton of ships when it came to traveling. If you had money and if you were someone important, or if you wanted to be noticed, you traveled on the gorgeous beauty, the Lady Elgin. She was a beauty, no doubt about it. She did gain a reputation, not a good one. You see, she would go on to be involved in several accidents throughout her very short lifetime. First, she hits a large rock in the waters of Manitowoc, Wisconsin, and she sinks. It's saved and repaired in 1854. And the very following year, another accident takes place, and she had to be towed to Chicago. And just a couple years later, in 1857, there is damage due to a fire. And the following year, the Lady Elgin strikes a reef, suffering damage. And just a couple months after the reef incident, she finds herself stranded in Lake Superior. The troubles continue on into 1859. In October, she suffers a breakage in her crossbeam. The very following month, the crank pin breaks. Now the next year will be her final year, sadly. Enter 1860. A schooner named Augusta slams right into the Lady Elgin, and the doomed ship sinks. This time, for good. She is dubbed as one of the greatest marine horrors that has ever taken place. 300 people would go to their watery graves, along with the Lady Elgin. A truly catastrophic event. 300 souls lost. The fatal voyage was taking members of Milwaukee's Union Guard to a campaign speech that was being conducted by a lawyer and U.S. Senator Stephen Douglas, who was going up against Honest Abe. The Augusta sustained very few injuries and assumed that Lady Elgin would be okay as well. And they leave and continue on to Chicago, believing that she would make her way to her destination as well. They couldn't have been more wrong. You see, the Lady Elgin suffered a huge blow, finding herself suddenly with a rather large hole in the side. And you better believe people, they're trying to plug that hole up with mattresses, anything that they could find. But it was no use. And it took only about a half hour for her to sink. Wiki goes into more heartbreaking detail. Quote, aboard Lady Elgin, Captain Wilson ordered that cattle and cargo be thrown overboard to lighten the load and raise the gaping hole in Lady Elgin's port side above water level while the steward was down in the coal bunker trying to stop the leak with mattresses. Captain Wilson ordered a lifeboat lowered on the starboard side to check the extent of damage, but never regained the steamer. Within 20 minutes, Lady Elgin broke apart and all but the bow section rapidly sank. The night was lit up at intervals by flashes of lightning showing the scattered wreckage. Two boats with a total of 18 persons reached shore. In addition, 14 people were saved on a large raft and many others on parts of the wreckage. Over 300 people died and 98 saved. The drummer of the German band Charles Beverung saved himself by using his large bass drum as a life preserver. Survivors reported the heroic efforts of Captain Wilson to save about 300 persons collected on a raft. When day broke, between 350 and 400 passengers and crew were drifting in stormy waters, holding on to anything they could, many only to be pulled under by breakers near shore. Students from Northwestern University and Garrett Biblical Institute were watching the shore on the morning of September 8th looking for survivors. One of the students, Edward Spencer, is credited with rescuing 17 passengers over the course of 6 hours. He sustained injuries during his rescue efforts that left him an invalid for the rest of his life. A plaque in his honor was first placed in the Northwestern University Gymnasium and is now housed in the Northwestern University Library. About 300 people died in the sinking, including Captain Wilson, who was lost trying to save two women when he was caught by the surf and forced into the rocks. Most were from Milwaukee, with the majority of those from the Irish communities, including nearly all of Milwaukee's Irish Union Guard. So many Irish-American political operatives died that day that the disaster has been credited with transferring the balance of political power in Milwaukee from the Irish to the Germans. It is said that more than 1,000 children were orphaned by the tragedy. However, research shows that there were fewer than 40 children orphaned. The Lady Elgin disaster remains the greatest loss of life on open water in the history of the Great Lakes. Unquote. I mean, let's face it, one child that is orphaned is one too many in my book. The Lady Elgin rests eternally in her watery grave at the bottom of Lake Michigan, just a few short miles away from shore. In 1887, the Vernon, a 177-foot, 700-ton steamer, sinks. And just a few short years later, in 1891, the Thomas Hume schooner sinks. Thomas Hume schooner was built in 1870, and it was a 132-foot, three-masted schooner with a 26-foot beam. It leaves Chicago one fateful day, heading to Muskegon, Michigan. The last confirmed sighting of the schooner was from the Ruth Simmons, who ironically would meet a watery grave 20 years later. More on that in just a moment. Now, on this particular day in mid-May, both the Rouse Simmons and the Thomas Hume, they were both headed to the same location. And when the Rouse Simmons arrives and doesn't see the schooner anywhere in sight, they begin to ask some questions. The owners, including Thomas Hume himself, demand that a search be conducted. And while an exhaustive search for the schooner and its crew was conducted, nothing is ever found. Well, until 115 years later. Wrecksite.eu goes into more detail. Quote, "Not until 2006 was the Thomas Hume mystery solved. That year, Taras Lysenko of AMT Recovery was searching for old Navy planes in Lake Michigan's southern end, working on behalf of the National Museum of Naval Aviation. This Chicago-based company has recovered over 30 World War II planes from Lake Michigan. Instead of an aircraft, Lysenko's sonar picked up the contours of a sizable schooner-shaped vessel. When a team of divers investigated, they were amazed to discover an almost entirely intact vessel. Unlike most shipwrecks, this vessel sank far out in the lake and at a great depth. Both factors, combined with the freshwater conditions, kept the ship in remarkably good condition. Even the ship's rigging and masts were still attached. Tools, coins, clothing, articles, and jewelry were found on the wreck, prompting Lysenko to describe it as a time capsule from 115 years ago. In 1894, a schooner named the Mr. St. Peter was found abandoned. Dinner was made and found sitting on the table, but it would never get eaten. It would go untouched. The crew, well, they were nowhere to be found. What happened that fateful day? Dinner was prepared and something happened before the crew could sit down and enjoy it. What took place that day and the fate of the crew? Well, it remains a mystery. A decade after the schooner Mr. St. Peter was found abandoned, the SS Appomattox, which was known for hauling coal and iron ore all throughout the Midwest, runs aground near Milwaukee in 1905. It was considered one of the largest ships to sail Lake Michigan at a whopping 319 feet. The Rouse Simmons, I mentioned that one earlier, it was built in 1868. Rouse was a 123-foot, three-masted schooner. It may have been named the Rouse Simmons, but it was better known as the Christmas Tree Ship. Its cargo mainly consisted of Christmas trees, so the name Christmas Tree Ship was extremely appropriate and quite cheery. November 22, 1912, they leave Thompson Harbor and begin their trek to Chicago, not knowing this would be their final trip. Their last voyage had them hauling 5,500 trees for the holidays. They suffer a heartbreaking fate when they find themselves stuck in the middle of an ever-so-violent and unforgiving storm. After its disappearance, debris would be found, including several trees, and personal items like a wallet and just much more. The whereabouts and fate of the 17 people, and the Ruth Simmons itself, of course, would remain a mystery. Until 59 years later, after it vanished in 1971, it would be discovered by a scuba diver who was actually out searching for a completely different wreckage, the 1887 remains of a steamer called the Vernon that I mentioned earlier. It was discovered in its watery grave, the Ruth Simmons, of 165 feet. Now, I just mentioned how World War II aircraft, how several were recovered by ANT Recovery, which is absolutely amazing. So I wanted to look more into World War II planes. So I'm going to read just a tiny bit of chunk of oceanexplorer.noaa.gov. Quote, nearly 200 military aircraft were lost in the Great Lakes during World War II. The vast majority of accidents occurred in Lower Lake Michigan, where Navy aviators attempted to qualify for carrier takeoffs and landings. The Army also lost pilots and aircraft in Lake St. Clair and Lake Huron. Dozens of foreign pilots, including French and Norwegian exiles training in North America, were also lost over water. Although many of the World War II aircraft wrecked in the Great Lakes have been recovered, the majority have not yet been found. I skip ahead a little in the same article. Two airplanes, both Bell P-39Q era Cobras, have recently been discovered in Michigan waters. Both were lost in training accidents and both were hidden beneath the water for many decades. Lieutenant Frank Moody was killed when his airplane crashed north of Port Huron on April 11, 1944, and Lieutenant Nathaniel Rayburg was killed when his Air Cobra crashed in Lake St. Clair, December 12, 1943. At least three additional aircraft flown by Tuskegee Airmen remain hidden in Lake Huron. A. Curtis P. 40F Warhawk, flown by 2nd Lieutenant Wilmeth W. Side Singh, crashed in Lake Huron off East Tawas on May 9, 1943. A Vol TBT-13A Valiant, piloted by 2nd Lieutenant Nathaniel Milton Hill with Weather Observer 2nd Lieutenant Luther Linson Blankney on board, crashed in Lake Huron, 2 miles off Oscoda, on June 16, 1943, and the Bell P-39Q era Cobra, piloted by 2nd Lieutenant William E. Hill, crashed into Lake Huron off Harrisville on November 22, 1943. The bodies of all the pilots, with the exception of 2nd Lieutenant William E. Hill, have been recovered. Just so incredibly heartbreaking. And again, hundreds of World War II planes, just from World War II. Imagine what other wars have gone down there. So my heart goes out to all of those heroes, and maybe someday they will all be found. So the next event was not about a boat and crew vanishing or meeting a watery grave, but specifically one person disappearing, never to be seen again. Enter George Donner. Captain George Donner was on his ship, the O.M. McFarland. The date? Well, it was April 28, 1937. George and his crew, they were navigating the ever-so-icy waters, and eventually he retires for the evening, calling it a night, and going to his cabin for some much-needed relaxation and to catch some shut-eye. Now, a few hours later, his crew go to his room to wake him up, let him know, hey, we're just about at our location, Port Washington. They knock.
George, are you there?
But no answer. Only silence greets them. No shuffling sounds, no snoring, no sounds of breathing, no anything. No answer. Zilch. Nada. Zip. So one man tries to open the door, but finds that it's locked from the inside. Was there an accident? Is Captain Donner unable to communicate with his crew? Did he have a heart attack? Is he in trouble? The crew had to do something, and quick. They eventually kick the door down and are utterly shocked when they find the room completely empty. No sign of the captain. They search that ship top to bottom, and they never find a single trace of the now missing man, Captain George Donner. It's not like there was a glass sliding door where he could have went out to a balcony and maybe fell overboard. The windows were very small, a grown man couldn't get out of them. I doubt a child could. And remember, it was locked from the inside. What happened? What exactly took place those few hours where he was left alone? The day that he disappeared? It was actually his birthday. So sad. Captain George Donner is never seen again. His body never found. To this day, what happened that day on the OM McFarland remains a complete and utter mystery. June 23rd of 1950, Flight 2501 leaves New York City and is en route to Seattle, Washington, with 58 people on board. While traveling over Lake Michigan, specifically that deadly triangle area, Captain Robert Lind communicates with Northwest Air Traffic Control Center, which is located in Chi-Town, and asks them if he can descend 2,500 feet. Because they were in what he described as an electrical storm, and it was accompanied by very inconvenient high winds. Now, believe it or not, this just makes me so mad, he was sadly denied his request, and they disappear shortly after this. That aircraft and its 58 occupants simply vanish. When they don't make it to their destination, the alarm bell is rang. A massive search is conducted, but no flight debris is ever found. Days after the flight vanishes, human remains do wash up on the coast. Unsure if it is related to the flight, but it definitely not 58 people accounting for all on board. Very, very heartbreaking indeed. The SS Carl D. Bradley was built in 1927, and it was dubbed Queen of the Lakes, the longest and largest freighter on the Great Lakes. It was a whopping, get this, 639 feet. Jeez-a-loo, that's huge. Well, November 18th of 1958, an explosion takes place. Distress calls, they're made. The hull splits in two and it sinks. The lifeboat gets entangled and, well, it's deemed unusable, useless, worthless. Psh, get out of here. Sadly, 33 people would die and only leave two survivors in its wake. February 20th, 1978, something truly mysterious takes place. A 23-year-old man named Stephen Kubacki was enjoying the day cross-country skiing on Lake Michigan. Mind you, it was winter time and the lake was frozen, so he was taking full advantage of that. I mean, who wouldn't? You're an outdoors person, you live in outdoors paradise, why not, right? Well, what should have really just been a simple day trip or a couple day trip or something turned out to be anything but. When Kubacki does not return back home, people are completely worried about him. There's no sign of him anywhere. He just vanished without a trace. They see where his marks were, cross-country skiing, but then they just like, stop. Where did he go? What happened? Days go by. Weeks go by. Weeks turn into months. Eventually a year goes by and there's still no word from or about Stephen Kubacki. Oftentimes, when someone is missing for that long, the outcome, let's face it, it's not a good one usually. Well, I'm happy to say that 1 year and 3 months later, Stephen Kubacki resurfaces, and he's very much alive, my friends. But nowhere close to where he was last seen, but instead found in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Which, by the way, is over a 12-hour drive. Away from Lake Michigan. You know, those were his last whereabouts. He was wearing clothing that really did not belong to him at all. In his possession, he had these weird, mysterious maps. 15 months had gone by, and yet he had no memory or recollection of where he was or what he did during this time. Now, I have definitely heard of lost time before. I've experienced it myself, just a few minutes, but 15 months that he cannot account for. That, in my opinion, is just absolutely terrifying. I cannot even imagine. So I don't know. I have several questions. Like the community as well, probably. Like, what was Stephen Kubacki doing for 15 months? What did he eat? How did he survive? Where was he exactly? Did he converse with people? And if so, what were those conversations like? How did he get from Lake Michigan all the way to Pittsfield, Massachusetts, which is over 700 miles away? Where did you get these weird maps? And where are these maps too? Who gave him the clothing that he was wearing? He obviously had to be communicating with someone in order to get the things that weren't there with him before, like the maps and the clothing. And if so, did they know he was a missing person? And if they did, then why did they not report him as being found? Was he, I dare to ask, abducted by aliens? And if so, why did they keep him for so long? What did they do to him? So many questions and not many answers. Not any answers, really, at all. When he was still missing, people didn't know if he had drowned. Maybe he was on the frozen lake and a patch fell through and he was trapped. This was around the time when very notorious serial killer John Wayne Gacy, the notorious killer clown, was claiming victims. Was he a victim of foul play? Did Stephen Kubacki run into John Wayne Gacy? Was he kidnapped? Did he just want to start a new life and he just up and vanished on his own accord? Maybe there was an accident and he got hurt. But it was none of those things. He was actually found and he was safe. And I believe healthy. Which is amazing. I mean, that rarely happens. So Stephen did write a book about his experience and it's titled The Disappearance. And that would be one hell of a book to read someday. So that's going on my list of books. I am, again, just so grateful and so happy that he was found alive. July 3rd of 1998, two gentlemen, Don Rodriguez and Don Schaller, were in a two-seat Aero L-39 jet. They had left Cherry Capital Airport at 6:30 p.m., and sadly, the trip would not last too terribly long, as less than 20 minutes later, 17 minutes to be exact, the plane and two men went completely off the radar south of the Fox Islands. This specific day was supposed to be a happy, celebratory, and cheerful one, as it was Don Schaller and his beautiful wife's 29th wedding anniversary, which makes this event even more heartbreaking. I quote the Herald Whig as they go into more detail, quote, Don Schaller was piloting a two-seat Czech-built Aero L-39 Albatross in the run-up to an air show as part of the Traverse City, Michigan National Cherry Festival Air Show. He was familiarizing himself with the air show area and took up a passenger, Don Rodriguez, a flight instructor at Northwestern Michigan College. The L-39, a military aircraft, took off and radar showed it going north, unquote. Now there was some communication and the flight tower was expecting to hear back from them when they were 5 minutes out, but that call never came. And the plane and the two men sadly disappeared from radar. The time that the men went missing, people in the area had claimed to hear sounds of a plane, and then it was followed by a large explosion, but they actually never saw the plane. Once more, I quote the Herald Whig. In 2008, another sonar search was done and found what could be a plane at a depth of more than 450 feet. It was near a boat that sank in the late 1950s. Divers later were asked to confirm the identity of the boat and the possible plane. That dive could not be completed due to a greater depth than had been anticipated and a diver who was not certified beyond 400 feet, unquote. Now, sadly, Rodriguez's family sued the Schaller family, amongst others. And this reminds me kind of the two missing boys in the Bermuda Triangle and how one family sued the other. I mean, come on, this is 100% a huge, catastrophic tragedy. Both families deserve respect and honor, and they're already going through most likely the hardest thing they ever have to go through. They're going through the same thing. The loss of a beloved family member. The uncertainty, not knowing what happened to them or where they are. Lawsuits are just absolutely ridiculous in situations like this. Like, you already have enough that you're going through. If anything, this should bring you closer because you're going through the same thing. That loss. Insult to injury, to severe injury, in my book. What happened that day exactly, and the men's whereabouts and that plane remain an utter mystery to this very day. With the disappearance of several people, drowning deaths, vanishing planes and boats, and possible UFO activity, the Michigan Triangle is definitely a beautiful but ever so mysterious and spooky location. I quote themorbidlibrary.com. The main otherworldly phenomena witnessed over the Michigan Triangle are visual in nature. There have been hundreds of reports of floating lights, often described as balls of fire. These have, unsurprisingly, been attributed to aliens and are possibly crafts themselves. One interesting thing that I haven't seen in regards to aliens in the Michigan Triangle is reports of USOs, unidentified submerged objects. If you come across any such reports, I'd love to see them. Strange weather is also a commonly reported phenomenon in the Michigan Triangle. I am listing this under the aliens header because it simply doesn't fit anywhere else, and could conceivably be the result of otherworldly technology. Reports of strange weather vary wildly, but mostly center around storms of some sort. Storms that pop up out of nowhere and disappear just as fast. Gale force winds that run ships to their watery graves and then vanish. And even in one case, mysterious blocks of ice fell from a cloudless sky. The ship that experienced this particular phenomena was called the Mary McLean. Its crew reported being out on Lake Michigan one calm, clear day. The water was not rough, and there was no sign of trouble on the horizon. And then, enormous chunks of ice began falling from the sky, pummeling the boat. Once they weathered the storm, the men returned to shore, apparently eager to share their strange tale, along with the proof that they had kept several chunks of ice that had left dents in their small vessel, and they had managed to preserve a piece of the ice as further evidence. Unquote. Some people believe that Lake Michigan is home to a portal. And it wouldn't shock me if every single one of these deadly triangles had a portal. I have always wanted to go to the Great Lakes, and maybe someday I will get to. Ever so beautiful, but ever so deadly. Do you remember the 3 F's rules? Flip, float, follow. Remember, it could save your life, could save a loved one's life, could save that stranger's life. Saving someone's life, flip, float, follow the safest path back to shore. Do not fight the current, swim to the side. Do it. Yes.
And that concludes another fantastic podcast. Legend has it, if you don't tune in, I'll be returning to haunt you. Mwahaha. So make sure to tune in for the next episode.
Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others. They're all phenomenal. Haven't heard every single damn one yet? Well, there's really no need to cry about it. Just hit up any of those phenomenal podcast platforms, such as Apple Core Media Library, Luminary, Podcast Addict, Spotify, iTunes. Basically, wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Prowlers Podcast lurking in the background. Thanks for stopping by, everyone, and
I will see you next week.